This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. On a brutally hot summer day in 1848, a 30-year-old enslaved woman named Mary Walker escaped her life of bondage. She left behind two families, her three children and a beloved mother, and the wealthy North Carolina owners that kept them as human property. Freedom from slavery came at a great emotional cost for Mary Walker. She spent nearly two decades trying to recover her family. It's likely her story would have faded into obscurity had it not been for historian Sidney Nathans. Sid spent the last 25 years researching Mary Walker, her ancestors, her descendants, her slave masters, and the relationship she made after running away. What he uncovered was a heroic saga of a woman whose bravery rivals that of household names like Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. But Mary Walker's story is illustrative of a more typical slave experience. Sidney Nathans is professor emeritus of history at Duke University. His new book is called To Free a Family, The Journey of Mary Walker, and he joins us now from the studios of Colorado Public Radio. Welcome, Sid.
Thank you very much.
Tell us how you first learned about Mary Walker.
I learned about Mary Walker in a letter that was published in a book, 1976, by Herbert Gutman called The Black Family in Slavery and Freedom. And there was a letter published in that book, written by a professor of mining at the University of Pennsylvania in 1859, that was a plea on Mary Walker's behalf to recover her children. And it was certainly the most poignant letter of thousands of letters that I ever read, and that pulled me into her story.
And tell us about her story. Where was the plantation where she worked and the family that owned her and hers?
Mary Walker was born on the Benahan Cameron Plantation of North Carolina, which is just about 10 miles north of Durham, in 1818. And she worked there as a seamstress and as a companion to the daughters of the plantation mistress. And she was really one of the first families of enslaved people on the plantation. Her mother was a seamstress and a companion. Her uncle was a skilled worker. So she was among the first family of the plantation.
And that that plantation, the Cameron Plantation in what is now Durham County, is now known as the Stagville Plantation. Is that right?
That's right. The Stagville is a historic site there, and the Cameron name has gone into Cameron Village in Raleigh and Cameron Avenue in Chapel Hill.
What was it about that letter written by Peter Leslie, the one that you discovered, that struck you as interesting?
The letter was an appeal on behalf of Mary Walker and reported her heartbreaking distress at the long loss of her children. She was fine, Peter Leslie reported, in terms of her physical care, in terms of her job, but her heart was slowly breaking, and she longed for the recovery of those children. Otherwise, her life would be one of continued agony. So it was really one that revealed the pain and the price of freedom for a woman who left her family behind.
So now we should find out how she won her freedom.
Well, won her freedom was not quite what happened. Yeah. She walked away from slavery in 1848, and it was a very undramatic gesture. She was in Philadelphia caring for the invalid daughter of her owner, who was there for the treatment of a mysterious disease. But in terms of the inner turmoil, walking away hardly describes it. She was abandoning her family. She was becoming a refugee. She was a woman of color from the South who was in a northern city. So in terms of the inner turbulence, there was every bit of drama to it.
And but it was a victory in a way, because freedom was something she wanted, and because of the Cameron family's visits to Philadelphia. And this was because they had a child who was sick and needed care that they got in Philadelphia. Is that right?
That's right.
So she's there. What made her, how did she make her escape, and how did she make it known that she wanted to escape?
Well, Philadelphia in the late 1840s had a strong underground railroad. These were people, mostly people of color, but also whites and blacks working together, who were on the lookout for fugitive slaves or enslaved people who were brought legally into Philadelphia as the servants of their white owners. So they had her spotted right away, and they communicated with her that if she decided to walk away from slavery, that they would help her. They would hide her. They would employ her. They would get her out of the city if she wanted to. So she knew that there was help if she chose to escape. But for three different summers until that last summer, she did not choose to leave that family.
And was this out of concern for her family?
Sure. Her family was 400 miles away. She had a mother in slavery. She had three children in slavery. And If she left that family without a word of explanation, they would think she had abandoned them, and they would be subject, she might think, to some kind of reprisal. So all of that had to go through her mind before she decided she would leave anyhow.
And interestingly enough, the Camerons were a family of slave owners who believed in keeping families together.
No doubt about that. This was one of the things that distinguished them from many other slaveholding families, but they had the wherewithal to do that. But the trade-off was that they would keep families together in return for loyal service and free labor on behalf of their enslaved people. But that was a practice that they followed for several generations.
So tell us what happened then. After a couple of summers, Mary decided to escape, to take up the offer of those around her who would help her. How did it happen?
Well, as you said, it was hot. It was August. Nothing in three summers of help for the daughter had proved availing. Duncan Cameron, the slave-owning patriarch, the father of the young woman, Mildred Cameron, was at the end of his tether. They went off to Cape May just to get out of the heat of Philadelphia, and there was a quarrel between Mary Walker and Duncan Cameron. I'm not quite sure what the quarrel was about. I think that it had something to do with the likelihood that there was going to be a new plantation in the Deep South that he was going to set up for his son, and that she was very attached to somebody on the plantation in North Carolina, and she said to him, "You're not going to send whoever it was to the Deep South," and that he said to her, "Who do you think you're talking to?" When a slave crossed an owner, it wasn't just back talk, it was impudence. And the punishment for impudence was banishment or whipping or both. So at that point, Mary Walker had to decide, was she going to go back and take a chance that she would be sent to the Deep South, or was she going to walk away from slavery? Either way, her family was lost to her. So something like that happened. There was no doubt there was a quarrel, and at that point, she walked away instead of taking the chance that she'd be sent to the Deep South.
So she has now a kind of different choice, a different set of circumstances that she's looking at with regard to her family. That's one thing. Is there any way that you could tell in your research the impact of the, let's call it the radicalization over those three summers, the talking with people who urged her to leave, that had on her thinking and on her decision?
What happened between 1846, when she first came, and 1848, when she left, was that there was a change in the laws of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There had been a law established in the early national period that allowed slaveholders to bring their enslaved servants to the North, and within 6 months, take them back to the South, and they would still be regarded as slaves. But there was by the mid-1840s, there was a Cold War going on between the North and the South, and Pennsylvania passed what's called a personal liberty law, which said anybody who was brought voluntarily into the state of Pennsylvania as a slave would be considered a free person. So she knew as of 1847 from her friends that that law was passed, and that if she walked away from slavery and stayed in Pennsylvania, she would be free. So to that extent, I think there was a radical change in the legal environment, which meant that no slaveholders and slave catchers could come after her that year.
So she stayed in Philadelphia immediately after she walked away, but the Camerons continued to come back to Philadelphia, and she eventually felt a little unsafe in that city. Tell us what happened next.
The Camerons did come back. They continued to go to the Jefferson College of Medicine, which was the Johns Hopkins of its day, and in 1850 they were back again. But there was a big change in September 1850. The personal liberties of the law had annoyed the South no end. They demanded their repeal, and finally they got that enacted through the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which now basically overrode all these personal liberty laws and made it illegal for anybody to hide or harbor or employ a slave. So at that point, Philadelphia becomes the West Africa of the United States. It's a magnet for slave catchers to go and seize these slaves. So at that point, she had to get out of Philadelphia. Her friends told her, and she found someone who wrote a friend in Boston who said, "Would you take in a fugitive slave?" And so she left again. So she really escaped twice.
And she ended up in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
That's right. The couple that took her in, Peter and Susan Leslie, lived in Boston. They did move back to Philadelphia, but they put Mary Walker in the care of an ailing mother of Susan Leslie, the woman who took Mary Walker in. And she moved to Cambridge in 1853, and that's where she lived the rest of her life.
Tell us about Peter Leslie. Well, who was he?
Peter Leslie became the state geologist of Pennsylvania. He was a professor of mining at the University of Pennsylvania when he wrote the 1859 letter. But in the 1840s, he was a minister. a fledgling minister tilting against orthodoxy in the Presbyterian Church, which is hopeless, and even in the Congregational Church, which didn't do much better for him. So the abolitionists looked at this guy, this young fledgling minister, and thought here was a soulmate. But he opposed getting involved in the abolition movement because he thought they were too strident, they exaggerated, they didn't have love in their hearts, until the Fugitive Slave Law. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, he was ready to shift over to active abolitionism.
And Peter's wife, Susan, is also an important character in the story. What do we know about her?
Well, Susan is a wonderful character. She writes beautifully. She is a very sensitive person. She's a woman who, I think, in her younger days, wanted a cause in her life and had some trouble finding it. It's when Mary Walker comes into her life, a fugitive slave whose children are left behind, that I think she really finds the cause of her life, and she becomes a wonderful advocate for her. But more than that, she becomes a friend. These are two women who both have lost children, Susan Leslie to miscarriage, Mary Walker to the escape. They had both knew about suffering and religion. So these were truly soulmates. And I think that there are very powerful, poignant moments that involve these two women as they become not just a white woman and a black woman, not just an abolitionist and a refugee slave, but two women who are very dear to each other.
Well, tell us more about their relationship, Mary's relationship with the family, what she did and how she kept herself those years in Cambridge.
Well, Mary Walker initially was a seamstress, a gifted seamstress. She was a seamstress for the white Camerons, and then when she moved to the north, she was a seamstress for white people in Milton and then in Cambridge. But after 1853, she becomes the caretaker for another invalid. This is basically the mother of Susan Leslie, whose invalidism is what we would today call Alzheimer's. So it doesn't take strictly a physical form, but the form of dementia. And Mary Walker becomes her caretaker for the entire decade of the 1850s. They didn't know what Alzheimer's was in those days. They didn't know about the care of it, but Mary Walker instinctively knew how to care for such a person, and yet at the same time not to be put off by the vacillations of that person. The family was profoundly grateful to her and indebted to her.
And, of course, she was paid, she was able to earn money, and actually had enough money to buy her children out of slavery, which is what generated the letter that Peter wrote.
She had money, which she saved every penny, but she also had friends who knew her story, who were moved by her story, and she knew she could call on them if their ransom request was higher than the money she had in her savings account. But yes, she saved every penny and she was prepared to use every penny.
And aside from that ransom attempt, there were other efforts to recover her children. Tell us about those.
In 1854, the context for this attempt is the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which creates huge animosity on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. And Peter Leslie decides, okay, enough of this trying to do this by the back door and by ransom. So he hires a rescue agent in Philadelphia. The rescue agent comes up to Boston, meets with Mary Walker at the home of the Underground Railroad leader of Boston, gives him an earring, which will identify him as the man who represents her. And then he goes down to Raleigh. He actually goes down to Raleigh twice and tries to make contact with Mary Walker's mother to show her the earring and say, I'm the man that your daughter has sent, and I want to rescue you from slavery.
All of those efforts failed, but she was ultimately reunited, and it's a remarkable story. Tell us that one.
In April of 1865, the occupying army moves into Raleigh, 15 miles outside of the city. Raleigh representatives go out and say, we surrender. There's no need to take our city or burn our city. They come in, and one of the leaders of Sherman's army is a man named Oliver O. Howard, after whom Howard University is named. He knows Mary Walker's story. He knows about her children. He finds them within a couple of hours, and he says, your mother is alive and well in Cambridge, and she wants you to join them. And that summer they did.
So tell us about them now. There were three children, one of them essentially lost to history, two others we know something about.
Her oldest son, Frank, had escaped in 1852, so he, despite her efforts to find him, was lost. The other two children, Agnes and Bryant, are 25 and 21 now. They come up to Cambridge. Bryant is a wonderful gardener. Agnes is a housekeeper and a seamstress. And they are Bryant marries an Irish woman in Cambridge, and Agnes comes up with her husband, who's a carpenter. So they all get into a household up there, and then they get into different households up there until 1870, when she buys a house in order to bring that family back together and keep them from being uprooted ever again.
One of the important things about your book, Sid, apart from the fact that it's a remarkable story, is how it gives lie to a kind of myth that slave families didn't really feel connected because of the threat of being sold and broken apart. There are some real deep connections among people and their families.
Absolutely. The letter that Peter Leslie wrote expresses Mary Walker's sense of loss and love. Her experience, I think, speaks for those who stayed behind to be with their families and to stay in slavery, even though they may have had the opportunity for short-term or long-term escapes from bondage. So I think it's not just the voice of refugees from slavery, of those who escape, but it's also the voice of those who stayed behind and took what they had to in order to be with their families and sustain their families.
And you also found some descendants of Mary Walker's family. What did you find out about them?
Well, I found out that they didn't know about Mary Walker. I found out that something I had already suspected, that their complexion changed from black to white, actually mixed race to white, and that there were reasons that in 1920s, when Jim Crow came to the North, that their memory of Mary Walker was suppressed. But I did find that this was a heritage, this was a person, this was a legacy that they embraced, and that was amazingly wonderful to me. They embraced their African-American, Irish-American, French-Canadian heritage. They embraced Mary Walker, and they, were in Cambridge last Thursday when I was there to give a talk, and they were front and center and stood and accepted the applause of the entire audience there for that embrace.
Deeply moving story. Thank you for spending so much of your life bringing it to light. Thank you, Sid.
Thank you.
Sidney Nathan's Professor Emeritus of History at Duke. His new book is called To Free a Family, The Journey of Mary Walker. That's the state of things for today. And this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.